With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Well, things are unraveling so quickly, I can't even keep up. Last week, it was McLean's, layoffs at McLean's magazines, Canadian Business Magazine, rumors that it's going under completely, and a staggering list of buyouts from the Ottawa Citizen. Staggering. 15 buyouts. Why are they so remarkable? Because they are the senior most reporters and editors at the Citizen. They are the Citizen. In many people's conception, these are the people who comprise what the Citizen has been doing. And what the Citizen has been doing is what you would expect a capital city newspaper to do. The Citizen is sort of our Washington Post. This is the paper, more than any other, that keeps a steady, scrutinizing eye on our federal government. And there is no one at the Citizen who is more associated with keeping an eye on our federal government than Glenn McGregor. Glenn McGregor, instrumental force, won all the awards for his many investigations. I mean, his investigations are like a list of the major political scandals in recent Canadian history. The In-N-Out scandal, the robocall scandal, the Duffy scandal. Big part of that was Robert Fife, but before Robert Fife, it was Glenn McGregor. McGregor is in some ways an old school investigative journalist. In some ways, he's new school. He's one of the first guys in the country to use data in his investigations. He did a really interesting look at all the spending that the federal government was doing under the Conservatives, and he found out that there was a disproportionate amount of spending going to Conservative ridings. It was going to ridings where the Conservatives had been elected, and it wasn't supposed to be. Story after story at the Citizen came as a result of Glenn McGregor, and it's just hard to imagine what the Citizen is going to be, not just with his absence, but with everybody else's. Where are these people going? Many of them are leaving journalism entirely, going into academia, going into other pursuits, politics perhaps. I don't know where Glenn's going. He won't tell me. I asked him where he's going next. Is he leaving journalism entirely? Is he leaving print journalism? Maybe he'll have told the world by the time you hear this podcast, but he wouldn't tell me. He agreed to talk about everything else, though. I had a lot of questions for Glenn McGregor. You can hear my conversation with him in just a minute. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Nicholas Friesen, Helena Zipp, Brooke Smith, David McCorkle, Joseph Polsani, Zoe, Marcus Elson, Phil Lichty, and Alan Duquette. Alan, why did you decide to be awesome?
I choose to support Canada Land because it makes my morning commute a whole lot more interesting.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world. And it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, patio season and socializing. And it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
This episode is also brought to you by our friends at FreshBooks.com, the cloud accounting solution for non-accountants. If you need to send invoices, if you need to track your time and bill for your hours or collect your expenses, if you are self-employed or running a small enterprise where it matters whether you spend hours and days figuring out your taxes at the end of the year, figuring out how much money you made, if you'd like to spend less time doing that, if you'd like to get paid quicker, and FreshBooks always seems to get me paid quicker, then you want to check this out. And here is something that I learned just this week about FreshBooks.com, because they look at their entire customer base and they have noticed something kind of incredible. On average, their customers double their revenue in 24 months. We don't know if it's because you use FreshBooks that your revenue doubles in 24 months, but that really is something worth considering. Maybe it's just an indication that when people get serious about themselves, serious about their careers, and then it just naturally follows that their businesses improve because they're caring more about their businesses and showing a bit more self-respect. Or maybe there is some magical attribute where if you start using FreshBooks, you get paid twice as much money within 2 years. I don't know, but I do know that if you check out FreshBooks for free for 30 days, it's a pretty good chance you're going to become a customer. And when you do, I hope you will tell them that Canada Land sent you.
Okay, so Glenn, the news came out just a couple days ago that you're leaving The Citizen, and then just this gutting revelation of 15 senior-most reporters and editors of The Citizen taking buyouts, your name on that list, Andrew Potter, others. And we're not going to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have anything to say about, you know, why any of those other people decided to go. I mean, I had my own reasons for moving on. Now, it had nothing to do with the company. I mean, the company has treated me exceptionally well. They've supported my journalism for 18 years, and it was a great place to work. And there's, I have no complaints. I'd never had any, you know, political interference in any of my reporting, even though, you know, some of the stuff I was doing was getting in people's faces a lot of time. It was the kind of thing that you think would trigger some blowback, but they never interfered in that process. So it was a really good experience, and you know, everybody knows the challenges the industry is facing right now. That's not a mystery. So,
you know, I'm not really looking for much of an explainer about why you would take a buyout or why all those other people would. I mean, as you suggest, it's self-evident what's happening in the industry and what's happening at Post Media. Nor am I really like looking for you to like trash talk The Citizen. I think what a lot of people are trying to fathom right now and get some, I mean, people are actually worried about this. Who's going to cover these things? And given a choice between, you know, this amalgamation of The Sun and The Citizen and the newsrooms being smashed together and throughout the Post Media chain, it seems like one paper in each market is being favored. The fact that The Sun's newsroom would be favored over The Citizen's is baffling, considering the work that's come out of The Citizen. And is there anything you can tell people who are just wondering about these things?
I don't even know that that's the case, to tell you the truth. And I'm at a disadvantage here because I work on The Hill, right? So I don't work out at the citizen proper. So I don't know, I have no idea what's really happening there. So, and it's, you know, it's all above my pay grade anyway. I do know that, I mean, at least for parliamentary journalism, people are still going to be doing great work reporting. I mean, there's more outlets covering the Hill now than any time I've ever seen in my career. I mean, you have the conventional media that still has bureaus with very strong reporters in all of them. CBC is ramping up its bureau. Globe and Mail just hired a bunch of people to work in their Ottawa bureau. And then you have outfits like iPolitics, which is, you know, relentless in covering the Hill at a certain level, and the Hill Times, which kind of covers the Hill like a, you know, like a small town newspaper. And then these new entrants like Vice and BuzzFeed, Huffington Post. So there's more eyeballs on what's going on in Parliament now than there has ever been. So I mean, I understand why people get nervous about these things when you have these shakeups at the corporate level. But in terms of the journalism that's being done, I don't think it's been compromised by this yet. And I mean, I honestly think there's a lot of churn that always goes on in journalism. And I think a lot of it happens when governments change hands. So we saw this bit back in 2006 when the Conservatives came in. There was some reshuffling. People were moving around. I think a lot of journalists see it as a good time to reassess what they've been doing and look for different things. And some people do go from journalism into government. James Cudmore from CBC just a couple weeks ago announced he was going to go work for the defense minister. And that's normal. And I don't think it's even – a lot of people like to believe it that it's some kind of indication of the political bias of the press gallery, which it isn't, because it's usually just a small percentage of people who go to what they sometimes call the dark side. So I don't see that as an indicator of any kind of bias. And I think it's just normal. And when that happens, then you get kind of a domino effect where somebody moves around and, you know, Bob Fife goes to the Globe and then, you know, someone else is going to go somewhere else. I mean, I think it's just kind of a natural thing that happens every once in a while. Is it exacerbated now by the difficulties the industry overall is facing? Yeah, probably. I mean, we know what the issues are on the revenue side. But I don't think that it's necessarily like some kind of mass exodus that people think it is.
You use the word normal so many times that it's making me even more skeptical. So editor-in-chief of The Citizen, Andrew Potter, leaving for academia, I believe. James?
He's going to work at McGill. Yeah.
Right. James Cudmore leaving for government. We're talking about, I mean, Jen Gerson made the point on my show a month ago. How many retirement parties do you go to? A lot of people take buyouts, but there aren't a lot of retirement parties.
Right.
So this isn't just the usual shift and churn and people like, you know, trading players from one news organization to the other. This is a senior generation, the people who maybe are best at this, a lot of them leaving the game entirely. And it's I'm not making any doomsday scenario projection here that's the end of political journalism. And it's great. We'll talk about the younger people and the new outfits that are doing this. But something is happening. This is not normal.
I'd have to see like the total numbers and look at it historically as what percentage of the press gallery is leaving now compared to people who left in the 90s or 80s.
Does not befit a former Frank magazine. I mean, you know, I think you've got skin in the game, and you're being careful about, you know, you've got your own next move in your career, and the sky is not falling. That's fine. But I mean, we just want to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people who are leaving now are of a certain age. I mean, we have a lot of people who are baby boomers who are moving on, right? And if you look at the period that the press gallery massively expanded was probably when those people were first getting their jobs in journalism in the 70s and 80s. And that's when the gallery, you know, went from being in the small outfit that you could probably fit into a decent-sized conference room to this behemoth now where we have like over 300 people, when you include all the camera people and technicians. There's a lot of people here. So, I think a lot of those people are reaching the age, and you know, they're in their 50s and 60s now. They've done it. They've gone through a series of governments, and they're thinking they'd like to either retire or move on. And I think some of the people who are leaving the business now are, although they're not quite retirement age, they are actually retiring or going to sort of a semi-retirement.
Yeah, but they're going to work for another 20 years, a lot of these people, I imagine, you included.
And then there's a lot of good opportunities for them to do that now, because there's all the kinds of little outlets that you can freelance for. I mean, one of my favorite colleagues is a guy named Alex Binkley, who used to work for Canadian Press. in the 1970s and 80s, and has great deep institutional knowledge. And he works in the hot room here with me because he freelances and contributes to a shipping magazine called Fair Play. So when I was writing about Paul Martin's shipping company back during the final days of the Martin government, he was a terrific resource. I could go and talk to him, and he would say, "Oh, you should be looking at this and this, and find out where this ship is registered and things like that." So there's those people, that institutional knowledge doesn't necessarily get flushed away when they leave mainstream news organizations. I think it stays. A lot of people, some of these startups we talked about that are using people like that. BlackRock's reporter is using a lot of those people to do that kind of journalism where they cover more of the regulatory policy side of things.
They're doing a very good job of going through procurement documents, the paper trails, and finding stories out of that.
Fantastic. Yeah, and that's a great source. And that's something that, yeah, younger people who are coming in, leaving journalism school right now, going to be getting their first jobs on the Hill, probably aren't up to speed on that stuff, but they'll learn it quickly.
Let's go back to when you were with Frank, and it's interesting for me to note that somebody can, you know, they say that every pirate eventually wants to be a captain, or, you know, everybody gets respectable with old age. Not to call you old, but Frank very much being throwing stones and from an outsider's perspective, irreverent and unflinching and taking on all comers. And can you put me back in that space and tell me how you got involved and what the atmosphere was like back in the heyday?
Sure. I mean, I never wanted to do journalism, and I didn't go to journalism school. I went to Ottawa U, and I was taking communications, which prepared me to do exactly nothing. But it was a fun 4 years in a bit. And then I finished, and I'd heard through channels that this startup magazine was looking for someone to sell advertising. So I went down there and I knew the editor, Michael Bate, a little bit through some friends. So they sent me out to try and sell like display ads in Frank. And I walked up and down Bank Street, the main drag here in Ottawa, going into every little store and sticking this horrible looking magazine in their face and saying, "Hey, you want to buy an ad?" And 3 days of that, I finally kind of limped back to the office, and they said, "Look, this is not going to work. No one's bought a single ad. It's not going to go." And they said, "Well, okay, do you have any ideas for a story?" And at that time, I had a bunch of friends who were going through the journalism program at Carleton, and they were complaining about the sexual harassment in the school there. So I wrote a story about this and gave it to the publisher, David Bentley, who now publishes All News Nova Scotia. And he looked at it and said, "Well, we can't publish that. It's incredibly libelous. But let me rewrite it." So he rewrote it in the Frank style. And then I stayed and then kept doing that for over 8 years, almost 9 years. And it was terrific. I mean, it was Frank gets knocked a lot for being inaccurate or for being reckless and offensive sometimes, and it is all of those things. But it really, I think it kind of made me the reporter I am, because the thing about working for Frank, and it was then it came out every 2 weeks, now it's almost sort of daily now because it's online, but back then you couldn't sit on any story you wrote had to be exclusive. It had to endure for 2 weeks, and you had to make sure no one else was going to get it. Otherwise, it would just you get run over. So it made you really kind of entrepreneurial. And if you can get somebody, you can call somebody up and say, "Hey, I'm calling from Frank Magazine," and get them to talk to you, that's a feat. So, you know, when I went to the Citizen, it was kind of fish in the barrel after that. It was comparatively easy. But I think that kind of approach where you're looking for the off-agenda stories and the inside story behind the thing that's on the front page of the Globe or the Star that day, that kind of taught me how to do that, and it was really valuable, that experience.
I think we probably need to do like an oral history of Frank at one point or another. I just remember like being in high school and seeing this terrible-looking thing. They wouldn't even keep it with the other magazines. It would be up in the convenience store like next to the lottery tickets, this black and white newsprint thing with kind of poorly photoshopped, kind of like a Mad magazine, but it always felt like more dirty than porn to me. And you get older and read the thing, and it's so written in this kind of silly jargon, and yet this became kind of a necessary pressure release valve. From as much as it might have been considered scurrilous or hated, there was no one else doing that sort of thing, and it seemed like you guys were the place to bring certain kinds of stories, and it broke a number of significant stories.
Yeah, and I mean, the running joke on that was that people would slide it inside their copy of Hustler magazine that they were buying, so the people wouldn't see them buying Frank. Yeah, it was in its heyday, and I'm talking about sort of the early to mid '90s when there was no competition from online. It was just that it was able to take stories that the mainstream press, and I hate that expression mainstream, but for lack of a better word, that they wouldn't publish or there was about them. So a lot of our coverage in the early days was about journalism and we do goofy stuff like, you know, charting the decline of Peter Mansbridge's marriage and things like that. It was all, you know, gossipy and fun, but it had a role too. And there was some serious stuff we did in the media on Mediafile. Kind of actually a lot of the stuff that you're doing now was kind of Frank's bread and butter back in that period.
Yeah, that remedial media column in Frank.
Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting how fine the line is. You know, you can be doing something and it feels like it's just completely derided and scorned and considered like gross tabloid gossip. But you're taking shots at Mike Duffy and expenses. And the next thing you know, that is a mainstream news story, a scandal that is, it goes up to the Prime Minister's office, and things can very quickly turn from, oh, why would you talk about that, to, well, this is obviously something that needs to be taken very, very seriously at the highest levels of government and by the mainstream media.
Yeah, well, Duffy was a regular target of Frank when I was there, and it was because that he seemed to know all the inside information but wouldn't share it. He talked about how he knew where all the bodies were buried on Parliament Hill. And Frank's line was, well, why don't you tell people then? You know, if that's the case, you're a journalist.
Aren't you sort of in that business? Yeah.
Yeah. So I did a story when I was there. I mean, I didn't do a lot of the media on media coverage. That was mostly Michael Bay who did it. But I did a story there about Duffy going to Duke University putatively to speak to Canadian studies students, because they have a Canadian studies program there. And he went on the radio and talked about how he was down there talking to these people who are fascinated by Canada, interested in politics. And as it turned out, we had a tip, and it turned out to be true. He was there actually at the Duke University Weight Loss Center, which is a fairly esteemed program for weight loss. And we confirmed it there, and we ran a story about it. And Duffy sued us over the headline, which was something like, it was something probably libelous in the headline, which I, in fairness, didn't write. And
you called him Mike Puffy. That was the Frank.
Well, Mike Puffy was the line they used to call him all the time. And we had the thing called the Puffster, which is kind of this ongoing cartoon strip,
right,
you know, kind of poking fun at him. Hey, that was fine. And then when I left Frank, Duffy was one of the first guys I called. And I phoned him up because I knew I was going to be working with him on the Hill, or at least bumping into him regularly. And I didn't want it to be awkward. So we had a great chat. And I really liked Mike, and he worked in the hot room where I work, which is the sort of bullpen in Center Block on the Hill. And he used to write his scripts for a show out of there, and his producer worked with him here. So I'd see him all the time, and we got along, like, famously for 9 years. I mean, I wouldn't say he was a close friend or anything like that, but, you know, we'd talk about stories sometimes, and it was terrific. And then when I started doing the stories about his expenses back in December 2012, I think it was the first one, he came out and accused me of trying to get payback for Frank because he had apparently won a lawsuit over that.
A settlement, was it?
I think it was a settlement. I mean, that's what Beta said. Yeah. Couple of times it was some kind of
over the weight loss story, and then his line is that you're trying to get payback by exposing his expenses.
And it was like, what are you talking about? Like, no, I just did it because it was a good story. Like, you know, it was interesting, and you're a public figure, and it was, you know, and also when I wrote that first story about his expenses that he'd been claiming, I didn't think it was going to be this big. Lead to what ultimately became the Senate expense scandal.
Might have had bearing on the last election. I mean, you know,
a big part of that was Bob Fife.
Definitely, yeah. But you were the first to write about Duffy's expenses being a problem. Am I right about that?
Yeah. So we wrote about that, and then we wrote about one. The story came like a month later that I did about him trying to get a health card from Prince Edward Island so that he would have some documentation to back up the claim that he lived there. And that's kind of when it really kind of kicked into full gear, and then. Yeah, and then Fife had that amazing story about Nigel Wright that really broke it open.
Credit's an interesting thing. I mean, part of it is, you know, people have a lot of reverence for, you know, the legwork and the intelligence and the thoroughness of going through, and, you know, you've been doing versions of data journalism for a long time, and certainly you're involved in that side of things. But a lot of it is sometimes just being the first to bring up a topic and introduce into the public discussion. It's okay to question this person in this area. And I think, you know, I've heard the expression, you throw a little chum in the water and you kind of break through a bit of a, you know, hesitancy that people have, shibboleth, it's, you know, oh, that's off limits. And once it's out there, it starts to become more of a collaborative thing. I mean, that's a big part of the process. It's just sort of...
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the press gallery is still kind of a herd animal. And it sometimes it takes a while for the direction of the herd to shift. And I'll give you a good example of that where it hasn't shifted yet, and I think it might still, is I had done a couple little... They weren't even stories. I don't think they were even published in the newspaper, but they were blog hits about the prime minister's wife and her clothing. And I got a lot of grief on this, like more than I've ever got on robocalls or anything like that. And a large part of it is because I think a lot of the people who followed me on Twitter were doing so because they didn't like the Tories and they would like the stories that Steve Marr and I were doing about Dean Del Mastro. We're
talking about the Trudeaus in Vogue now.
Yeah, the Trudeaus, not just in Vogue. I mean, that came a little bit after... We'd already done a few things about this relationship she seemed to have to her stylist, who is Jessica Mulrooney, right? So she'd be the daughter-in-law of the former prime minister.
You took it on the chin for that. I was getting a lot of abuse on social media.
And it was just, I mean, I thought it was an interesting story because here what you have Jessica Mulrooney, who had this relationship at one time with Burke's Jewelers and also with the Bay, sort of the high-end line at the Hudson's Bay, and she was apparently acting as the stylist for Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, helping choose which clothes she was going to wear. And then she shows up for a meeting with the Queen in London, and she's got this brooch on that comes from Burke's, and it's worth like $7,000. And Burke's put out a press release. I'm starting to go, well, wait a second, like, do we really want the prime minister's wife to be kind of a walking billboard for the Canadian fashion industry? I mean, I think it's great that she's supporting Canadian designers and companies.
But it felt like a co-branding exercise or something.
Yeah, it's like a really valuable product placement she was giving. And then we found out like there was more, there's other ones that were a bit like that, like Sophie's, I guess maybe half-sister-in-law, so that would be Margaret Trudeau's daughter, worked for this Montreal hipster clothing line called Moose Knuckles. And sure enough, Sophie shows up in Europe wearing a jacket from Moose Knuckles. And Moose Knuckles puts out stuff on the social media highlighting this. So it was just getting a little bit too close. And it wasn't quite ready for prime time, that story, yet. I was just kind of, I was writing blog posts about it. I was raising some questions.
Yeah.
And then they show up in Vogue, right? And she's wearing this $7,000 or $6,000 dress. And it just seemed like, I don't know. And so I started... I don't think I even wrote about that. I think I started putting out stuff on Twitter about it, saying, "Is this really the role that she should be doing? I mean, is this appropriate? You know, you've got 7% unemployment, and you know, our economy, the price of oil is where it is, and Alberta's about to become a dust bowl. Do we really want the prime minister posing in high-end fashion magazines?" So then I was accused of being a sexist because if he'd posed, in Sports Illustrated, it would have been a different story. And anyway, it was a fascinating little exercise to go through. And I think, though, but I mean, you talk about, just to circle back to what you're saying about throwing chum in the water. There's chum in the water now, I think, a little bit about her and this kind of stuff. And I know they've kind of scaled that back a little bit. You don't see them doing so much of that right now. And I think I think she could become an ongoing story of interest to the press gallery. There was that strange moment on Martin Luther King Day where she broke into song at Ottawa City Hall. So she's going to be interesting, like, you know,
declaring fair game, I guess. And it's the kind of thing where I think you can take some knocks for, you know, people considering it trivial or gossipy. And yet you never know where something's going to go. I mean, you start talking about Duffy's, I mean, first it starts with the weight loss, not that that's necessarily connected, though he would say so. But then you talk about the expenses. And then even once you're at the point of, like, I think a lot of people say, well, so what about these Senate expenses? We probably figured they were doing that. But then you start to get this insight into the PMO and what kind of levers get pulled and a personal check being written, you know. Yeah. You never know when you start to tug on a thread where it's going to take you. I don't know. I think the first step is just being willing to put yourself in front of that and say, look, it's not my job to be classy or liked. You know, it's my job to poke.
Journalism is not a popularity contest, and you got to be prepared to get up people's noses. And it really offends people when you're doing stories, not so much on the public policy front, when you're doing things that are more personal like that, like Duffy's weight loss or like Sophie's designer outfits.
Well, we're very proper here, like that, and that's still something that gets done routinely elsewhere. But it's you know, the public, I think, is very quick to kind of dismiss that kind of stuff. But I think that, you know, there's the nice side of that we want to be a little bit more elevated in our discourse than perhaps America or, like, you know, this kind of rabid British press. But then when you see the connection between those little stories and what they turn into, there's I think a flip side to being a bit too proper, where I even look at kind of the way that these things ultimately play out. Like, if in the United States we found out that the chief of staff for Barack Obama wrote like a personal check to a senator that later was the subject of bribery charges. I don't think that would, like, it feels like, even though these things become, you know, the front and center, the biggest story in the country, all of these scandals at the end kind of get muted. Not, you know, would you agree with this? You see what I'm getting at? Not like put under the rug, but like, what is the outcome of ultimately of Gerald Regan? What is the outcome ultimately of the Duffy Gate Nigel Wright thing? What is the outcome ultimately of the robocalls thing? I mean, it lands on one staffer and everybody kind of forgets about it and moves on. And, you know, we never had a moment where, like, you know, Nixon resigning. There's nothing, the consequences, Airbus, all these things. It always seems to kind of like go out with a whimper.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the Canadian condition too. Like, we're all just too kind of nice about these things, and we don't want it to be awkward, and we want to smooth things over and let it go. You know, in fairness, the Duffy thing, you know, the press gallery completely turned on that, and that was consumed by it. So, and it, whatever the outcome of his trial is, I struggle to wonder how he's going to, if he were acquitted on all the 31 charges, if he's going to be able to come back into the Senate and.
Yeah, I'm more focused on how I mean, you might argue that Harper did not get out of that unscathed because it had an impact on the election, but why Nigel Wright? I mean, how can you have somebody accepting a bribe but not giving one? And some of the stuff that happened where it might have been more than just a Senate story, it felt like that was kind of dealt with effectively.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think our political culture here isn't nearly as vicious. And keep in mind, like, the country is still run by a fairly small group of essentially aristocrats from West Mountain, Forest Hill, you know, that really is a clubbiness to it. And that's why I find that, maybe this goes back to my Frank background, but I find those kinds of relationships the most interesting. The fact that Brian Mulroney and Paul Martin, you know, were sort of neighbors or lived nearby and went to all the same parties in West Mount. You know,
it tells you a ton. And there's this, like, oh, don't go there. What's it your business? Who's at whose wedding? Who's married to who? Yeah. But it tells you quite a bit. And, like, why the public shouldn't be aware of those relationships, I can't
imagine.
That's
right. And there seems to be the sense of, well, we shouldn't get into this stuff because it's not proper. And there's such an enormous collision between the political class and the business world in Canada that I don't think they would be tolerated in the United States.
Now, we haven't even started to go there, but that's really where there's a web.
Look at our new finance minister. I mean, this is a guy, you know, Bill Morneau, very nice guy, seems really honorable intentions. I think he's into politics for the right reasons. He's an extremely wealthy guy. He's the richest guy to serve in cabinet since Paul Martin. He has a place in Provence, and he has still, although he stepped away from his company business, this Morneau Chappell, this big HR and pension firm, he still, as far as I know, owns a large chunk of it. That's going to collide regularly with his public interest as finance minister. And yet it's one of those stories that people are like, oh, well, you know, we don't want to get into his personal stuff. Right? There seems to be this thing about, oh, you can't intrude in someone's personal life, that as soon as you start asking about family connections or where they live or, you know, even what kind of clothes they like to wear, then it's seen as being beyond the pale that you've pushed. But you don't know how it's going to turn out, right? Like, you don't know where that's going to lead.
When you follow it could go anywhere.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's always, I mean, especially at the time the Citizens really interested me the most, is the space between the personal and the public with particularly with cabinet ministers, you know, how this can possibly color. And it really came to the fore with Paul Martin, and he owned a company that was probably worth about $600 million. And as prime minister, that would regularly conflict with some of the things that he was having to make decisions about in terms of foreign policy, on taxation, all those things. And his eventual response was, okay, I'm going to sell the company to my kids. And that seemed to be enough for people, right? They said, okay, well, fine. Right. Yeah, it's, you know, no conflict there anymore. That still galls me that was considered acceptable. In the U.S., there's no way someone would, you know, a cabinet secretary would be able to get away with that.
Well, there's a lot that galls, and it seems like, you know, something is done, and that whatever it is, it seems to placate. And, you know, the robocall thing, we're talking about a scandal that involves the basic essence of democracy, like depriving people of their vote, confusing them from their vote, removing them from their vote, taking them away from their role as a citizen. And for this ultimately to rise up, okay, finally it's recognized that it happened, but one 22-year-old is held responsible?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that that's you won. Did you win the Missioner for that one?
Our news organization won the Missioner, yeah.
You guys won the Missioner for that. I mean, this is, of course, what investigative journalism should be finding, and it's why, you know, to loop back on all these people, including yourself, leaving the Citizen. Like, that's the kind of stuff I wonder who's going to break the next story like that. And yet, as much as it can be kind of like a pinnacle of your career, I don't think we know everything that happened. I don't think that everybody was held responsible.
No, it's a story that's kind of unfinished and incomplete. Yeah. And it may be as it seems. I mean, you know, when Steve Marr and I were working on this, we'd argue back and forth about what we thought really happened. And I was always kind of being the doubter and the denier, saying maybe it was just one guy. Maybe it was just Mike Sona acting alone, and maybe there was no conspiracy.
But you got to do that when you're investigating. You got to try hypothesis to see, does it fit?
I mean, that's what the court has said, right? I mean, it could be the court has said there's probably other people were involved, but they might have been minor players too. I mean, it could be that there was no involvement of the party. And, you know, the robocalls thing showed, we got an enormous amount of kudos for that, and it was lovely to win awards and go to fancy parties at the Governor General's. I still think the stories that Tim Nomas and I did on the In-N-Out scandal back in 2006, 2007 were more important and were more incriminating for the conservatives with respect to election law than the robocalls was. But it wasn't sexy, right? It was really hard to explain. It was essentially an accounting shell game where they were moving money around through wire transfers. But it was the people in the top ranks of the Conservative Party who were involved in this, and they did it willingly, trying to game the elections law to spend over $1 million more on advertising than anybody else did in the election campaign. And it made a difference. I mean, that was, you can go and buy $1 million more broadcast advertising in the final days of a closely fought campaign. That matters. The robocalls thing, it didn't even work in Guelph, right? So, like, you know, it was an attempt, and at its lowest level, it could have been essentially a college prank by a couple of kids that failed, or it could have been something more than that. We don't know. But the In-N-Out case, you know, we've got an admission of guilt from the Conservative Party in court that they had done this, and it was really bad. And that thing, I think it set the tone for the next few years that they could get away with it because they didn't really suffer any serious consequences. I mean, John Iveson, my colleague, described it as a bicycle crash, saying that it was, people didn't care about it. It wasn't interesting. And then the thing that made robocall sexy was you had this mysterious figure, Pierre Poutin. We had this long, drawn-out chase through the court documents and, you know, people using, you know, technology to hide their IP addresses. And it was really fun. You know, it was like something to see. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good story to tell. I mean, to me, it was really disgusting. Just the sneering, like, joke of, oh, we'll call this character Pierre Poutine as we subvert the democratic process.
Yeah, I mean, it was delicious. I mean, there's this great moment when Steve and I were working on this, and we had having these court documents faxed to us. We'd already written our first story on it, but we didn't know who Pierre Poutine was. And we had these court documents faxed to us from Edmonton, where the investigator had filed an affidavit saying what he knows so far that he's learned through his investigation. And then we see the name Pierre Poutine come up on the fax machine, and Mara and I just turned to each other and we either hugged or high-fived or something, because we knew this was an incredible hook, and it gave the scandal a presence in a face. And so Marr immediately started writing the story, and I ran over to my computer and tweeted something about how the name Pierre Poutine is going to be on everyone's lips, and it remains.
You know, the Canadian temperament and the culture gets blamed for why these things don't have more consequences and why people don't care more and how governments can even carry on after these things are exposed. Part of me just wonders if we're just lacking in the nonfiction section, journalism and people's interest in journalism, but these are great stories that never get dramatized. I mean, Duffy is an incredible figure. You know, when you talk about a journalist who keeps secret files and is more of a power broker and a glad hander who's got his eye on the Senate, I mean, you couldn't make a character like that up. And yet we never kind of get that story told. We never get these stories put to people in ways that Hollywood does a pretty good job in the States, I think, of telling stories about their public life and their political culture.
So you think maybe we should do the people versus Michael Duffy?
Maybe. Sort of the thing is that I know that it would be terrible. Series. I know that if we did make it, it would be bad. That's the thing.
That's the thing. We're not good at that stuff. You know, we're just, you know, we were talking about the other night about whether Marr wrote a pretty good book, fictionalized book called Deadline, about a press gallery reporter and, you know, gets drawn into this whole intrigue and murder and sex and stuff. And like, could that work as a television miniseries? And you're like, yeah, it would be fantastic. Except we would screw it up. It would be like they'd put Eric Peterson in the lead or something like that. It'd be dreadful.
As much as the public might at times take issue with you, you are on their side. You're trying to tell them things. And your job is just to get this stuff out in front of them. And it's terrific fun.
Well, that's nice of you to say. It makes it sound a lot more honorable than it really is. I mean, I'm not driven by any great kind of desire to represent the interests of the people.
Yeah.
It's like getting good stories. It's like getting on the front page. I mean, journalists are we're all egomaniacs, right? We all want to see our name in print above the fold. We want to have a story that people are going to talk about.
Sure, and the hunt is fun, and the adrenaline of the whole situation, and seeing a story break through, all that's fun and not necessarily appealing to these higher principles. And yet I think you can take solace at the end of the day that if you've contributed to people having a greater understanding of what the hell's going on, it's a noble thing to do, whether that's what got you in it or not.
Look, I'm not going into government, and I couldn't, because, I mean, if I was to go into government now, it would indict everything I've done over the past. Especially if I went into the Liberal government right now. You know, as a lot of people in the press gallery are thinking about doing, because there's these job openings and, you know, chief of staff jobs that pay pretty well and DCOM jobs. But that would be
a bit more of a guaranteed future than.
I think I'd be terrible in government. I would just want to leak everything to reporters because I'd recognize, oh my God, if I saw a memo and thought that's a great story, somebody should know that. That would be my instinct. I would be a disaster. No, I'm not going to go into government.
Glenn, thank you.
Thanks, Eddie.
That's your Canada Land Show. Hope you enjoyed it. You can always email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all and I respond when I can. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com. And our crowdfunding site is at patreon.com/CanadaLand. The second installment of Canada Land at the Movies will be on Thursday, February 25th at the Review Cinema. My guest will be Robin Doolittle of the Globe and Mail, and the film will be Shattered Glass. If you want to buy tickets in advance, check out our Facebook page. The next episode of Canada Land Commons will be up on Tuesday. The next episode of Canada Land Shortcuts will be up on Thursday. I make this show with Katie Jensen. If you like what we do, please support us.